Hello, everybody. Welcome again to our Heart to Heart in this new year, 2025. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Edwin Kelly, but you've probably listened to me in Vice Journal Online, seen my presence. Thanks for being here today. I didn't get to do a Dharma Geek session early this month because we were on vacation for the Christmas New Year period. But now we're back to doing these sessions, and Kuntum is doing her sessions, and I'll be doing a Dharma Geek session again next month. So we are progressing on here in our Abhidharma teachings. After a couple of months spent getting introduced to Vasubandhu's amazing text and Mingo Rinpoche's practice manual that he so wonderfully wrote for us when he was in lockdown during COVID, and then looking at the Four Noble Truths and the four foundations of mindfulness, etc., the five aggregates, getting a general framework for what these practices entail and the way in which this tradition of understanding gives us a lens to observe our mind-body experience. And so now, this month, or in this module, we begin the practice aspect of it, particularly. And in the introduction, Rinpoche talks at length about shamatha and vipassana. I talked a little bit about it too. This is the path, and it's not only the path that exists here with from Vasubandhu's Abhidhamma teachings. It's also exactly what we do in the Joy of Living and the Path of Liberation. It's all shamatha and vipassana. It's the teachings that the Buddha shared with us and every practicing Buddhist subsequently in the last 2600 years has employed these techniques to gain awakening. It's a tried and trusted path. These techniques have been around for centuries and they work, which is kind of cool. But this month, we are starting specifically with the shamatha practices. I think there's something like six different practices, beginning with counting the breath right through until the last one, actually, probably should be classified as vipassana, the meditation on the impermanent nature of the breath. It's at that point, the last session in this module, that we begin to switch from shamatha to vipassana. And I think the thing that is most important to understand that in order for vipassana or the insight or the wisdom practices to really take root, we first of all need to be able to stabilize our mind. We need to be able to mitigate the distractions. We need to be able to, our mind needs to be pliable enough so that, and stable enough so that we can direct our inquiry and our observation to the granular level of our experience. Because while ever or if and unless we don't stabilize our mind, it's going to be all over the shop, chasing after all sorts of wonderful things and not really paying attention to what's going on at this deeper level of mind-body experience. So that's the context in which we're entering into these practices. As I said, shamatha and vipassana is part of all Buddhist traditions that I've ever studied or practiced. They vary somewhat from tradition to tradition just because of the way the tradition has been preserved and the cultural context, the centuries of transmission, the lineage from generation to generation, etc. But at their core, they are all essentially founded in this process of stabilizing the mind and then inquiring or investigating the nature of our experience, which gives rise then to wisdom, to insight, and ultimately realization. Okay, I've said enough. Please, in these heart-to-heart sessions, I'd like to invite you to just raise your hand and ask any questions, make any comments, share with us how it's going, what's difficult, what's challenging, what's working, anything you might like to bring to the forum, please do. So the floor is open. Don't be shy. I assume you've all had time to look at the new material that just got released there, Micah. Am I saying that right, Micah?
Yes, perfect. Thank you. Yeah, I'll just share that I've been practicing with counting the breaths, and in the simplicity of how the practice and the view is presented, that using the breath as a way to experience and practice the Four Noble Truths. It's so I find it so elegant and intriguing in its simplicity. And so I've it, you know so I so I've been practice I've been doing the practice count you know counting the counting my breath. And I don't know that I have anything profound to share about it, other than I find it, I'm still inspired and intrigued, and in pursuing the practice. And I also appreciated your I think the your reflections when you were sharing about and I'm not necessarily sure how this relates to where we are in the module, but you shared about the first teachings you got or heard from Mingyur Rinpoche, which was, we hear from him so often, which is that the critical ingredients of practice being refuge, bodhicitta, guru yoga, main practice, and dedication, and how you have incorporated that both in since then in your formal practice, and then also infusing your informal practice with that. And that's something I've been taken with in hearing Rinpoche, and sort of time after time, sort of retreat after retreat, or answering question after question. It seems like he repeats it so often. And then, and then to hear how impactful it's been for you was really inspiring and intriguing. And now I forget how you related it to the specific Abhidharma teachings, but anyways, wanted to share that.
Thanks, Micah. Yes, it was very impactful, those teachings. I think it was like 2000, 2002, something like that. Yeah, one of the first retreats. I think it might have been the second night retreat, actually, or a time that I met went to programs with Mingyur Rinpoche. And it did, it really, it was like the thing that I really loved about it. It was so simple, so precise, and so direct. It was like oh, there's five things. Just do it every time you sit down. That's it. It doesn't matter, because we can so easily get somewhat bamboozled by the plethora of offerings. Just go to Vajrayana online if you want to be bamboozled. And all the different schools, all the different teachers, all the different methods, etc. And that somehow or other just distilled the practice for me in such a simple formula. And it also, I don't know whether it's such the case now in Toga, but it certainly was back then. I felt like he gave me the license to, as long as I got those bits, I can do it however I want. It wasn't so much about the method. And what it did is it liberated me to practice in a way that fit for me, if that's the right way of putting it, or worked for me. It was like I could craft the fabric of my own practice in a way that resonated for me, and that I found incredibly liberating. And of course, in all of that, there's incredible devotion and in the application. And the more I applied, the more I practiced, the more I got in tune with that formula of refuge, bodhicitta, guru yoga, main practice, whatever it was, and the dedication. And to do that as a bookend for any practice, formal practice, and then to bring it out into my daily life also. Kind of what that did was it invited the mundane of my everyday life to be part of my practice. It wasn't something separate from my practice. And that kind of took me to a whole nother dimension in some way that I'm really, really grateful for. So thanks for mentioning that.
Can you say something about how the practice of guru yoga, how that has been for you, or just and how you incorporate that into your off the cushion practice?
Yeah, I mean, Guru Yoga, I think, is probably one of the most misunderstood aspects of Vajrayana Buddhism, and rightly so, because I think from a contemporary modern perspective, particularly what those of us who have some basic understanding of psychology, and I'm not a psychologist, but the whole notion of transference and worship and adulation and elevating a teacher on a pedestal and all that sort of stuff, as we know, and many of us have experienced in different traditions, can be problematic. And it's really helpful to know that's not what guru yoga is, certainly from my understanding. But in line with the view that is prevalent throughout all of Vajrayana, this understanding that we are endowed with inherent goodness. We all have at our core, our true nature is Buddha nature. Then this practice of guru yoga is really an accelerant for us to get in touch with our Buddha nature. And we do that by reverence of the lineage and our teacher and that all that that represents for generations prior to us. Here we are, just ordinary, beings here on this planet, and we have the great fortune to find somebody who's got the authentic teachings. And that person has got those authentic teachings because he had a teacher, and he or she had a teacher, and he or she had a teacher, and he or she had a teacher, etc., etc., all the way back to the source of this wisdom. And they, through their own diligence, their own practice, their own study, they have preserved these teachings and manifest or realized the fruit of these teachings. And because of all of that practice and all of that effort, we now have this incredible opportunity to do the same. And so, what we're doing is we're inviting or supplicating our teacher to bless us so that we too might realize the fruit of this practice. That's what guru yoga is. And how do we do that? We invite them to bless us. We imagine them in the form of Shakyamuni Buddha or Vajradhara Buddha or Yidam or Bodhisattva, whatever form works for us. And they represent then all the enlightened qualities of the Bodhisattvas and the Buddhas of the 10 directions and the three times. That's what they represent. And we're inviting all of that to bless us so that we too might realize the nature of our mind. We might become liberated. And when we invoke that, Then we dissolve that enlightened energy, that enlightened qualities, body, speech, and mind into our own being so that it ignites the awakening of our own Buddha nature. And then we just rest in that recognition. That, in essence, is what Guru Yoga is, as I understand it. And so it's a way for us to directly ignite our the recognition of our own Buddha nature because of the lineage, because of the privilege of the benefit of having being in the presence of such an awakened being, or and the fruits of the lineage. And it's one of the things you won't find guru yoga practice in the other traditions, like in the Mahayana or the Hinayana. It is unique to Vajrayana. One of the metaphors that I've heard, it's like if you have a, you've probably seen, if you've got a candle that's lit and you've got an unlit candle, if you bring the light lit candle to the unlit candle, it'll actually jump. The flame will jump to the unlit candle very quickly. And so that's the metaphor for how the enlightened qualities of the guru can ignite the enlightened qualities of the student. That's guru yoga, as I understand it. Yeah, so having said that, the other part of your question. So when I first wake up in the morning, I do refuge, bodhicitta, guru yoga before I even get out of bed. And sometimes it starts happening as I'm waking up. And I've developed this capacity to somehow or other it works, and I don't know how it works. I've got my own way I do refuge. I don't quote the Buddha, the Tibetan. I actually learned refuge in Sanskrit Pali. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami. So I say refuge in Sanskrit every day, every morning. And then I do some phrases for the Four Immeasurables and Bodhicitta that I've kind of borrowed from everywhere and made it up myself. And then I do a little guru. I do it all in English, except for the Sanskrit. And the amazing part about it is sometimes I fall asleep back to sleep before I finish it. And then when I wake up again, I know exactly where I was and where I was and what I was saying. And I can just start from where I was. I don't know how it works. I can't figure it out. But it happens every day. Some days I can stay awake for the whole thing. Sometimes I drift off somewhere in guru yoga. Sometimes I drift off before I even finish the gachamis. And it's really bizarre. But that's what I do every morning before I get out of bed. And then every night, when I put my head down on the pillow, I dedicate my day to the welfare and happiness, whatever virtue. And sometimes I wonder whether there was any, whatever virtue I may have accumulated in my day, may I dedicate it to the welfare and happiness of all beings. May they quickly realize the state of Vajradhara, and I fall asleep. So it's interesting. Then it doesn't matter. Yeah, then my whole day, whether it's formal practice or informal practice, and that's a whole other story, formal and informal practice, but it kind of invites my whole day. And there are times when I've also done aspirations as I fall asleep to have lucid dreaming, because Rinpoche gave me specific instruction about that way, 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 way back whenever. And that's been fun too. Mostly I do that one if I do a retreat, but that's a different story. So yeah.
Thank you.
Interesting, huh? Interesting stuff. Bruce.
Yeah, I so in Stephen Goodwin's book, I just got up to part three, the first chapters of the mind. It was very interesting and very confusing. But there's one part of it where they talk about what's the distraction of the mind. And basically they say it's the five senses. So that had me wondering, I mean, can you get into the mind and just, for lack of any better word, disregard the five senses and just be in the mind? And if so, what's that like?
Oh, yeah, good question. I mean, there are many models within the Tibet, within the Buddhist tradition for the mind. Nyingma Rinpoche talks about the eight consciousnesses. The Abhidhamma really only talks about the six consciousnesses. The Theravada Abhidhamma adds the Alaya Vijñana, as does the later Mahayana Vajrayana teachings in the Tibetan tradition. But you won't find the Alaya Vijñana, the storehouse consciousness mentioned in Vasubandhu's Abhidhamma, I don't believe. But the Abhidhamma basically says that we have five sense perception. And this whole thing of the dhatus or the ayatanas, the fact that there is a sense organ, the ear, the sense object, the sound, and then the sense consciousness, in this case, the consciousness of sound. And those three elements need to be together in order for us to have a sensory experience. There is three for each of the five senses and three for the content of the mind, like thoughts, memories, plans, imagination, anything that's not a direct perception from one of the five fundamental senses falls into the category of the mind, of the mind. And so what your original quote, what Stephen Goodman is saying is that that it's stuff that appears at the five senses or even the sixth sense, I would say, that is the distraction. Something, we hear something we like or we don't like, we see something we like or we don't like, we smell, we taste, we feel, we think something we like. Now, next thing you know, we're down the rabbit hole, enamored by whatever the appearance
Yeah,
was.
distracted. Yeah, I get
Yes.
that.
Yeah. So what's the mind without distraction? The mind without distraction is still the same mind as the mind that is distracted, except that it's present. It has mindfulness. It has this quality of remembering to connect to the knowing quality of the mind, cognizance itself. Now, of course, if you've studied with Rinpoche and the Path of Liberation, the nature of mind goes beyond just the six consciousnesses that are part of the Abhidhamma teachings. And the six consciousnesses are very much the purview of the relative reality and the pure awareness, timeless awareness. The nature of mind is beyond the conditioned elements of the six senses because it is equivalent to nirvana or
Eternity.
the
It's like
unconditioned.
eternity.
Yes.
Everything. It's no beginning, no ending.
Yes, it's unborn, it's deathless, it's not conditioned, it's not conceptual, it's ineffable. These are all the epithets that come from the teachings of the Buddha for nirvana or the nature of mind. Exactly. And so because it's non-conceptual, don't matter what we say about it, it's not it. And the beauty of it is that it's only possible to know it by our experience, and it's only possible our experience, we can only know it if it's been introduced to us, and it's only accessible through practice, not through any sort of intellectual discourse or
Right,
intellectual
yeah.
in examination or investigation. Well, the inquiry of Vipassana will lead us to the experience. Yes. It's empty in essence and cognizant in nature.
So I keep on thinking that, like if you could shut down the five senses, not that I want to get rid of them just for a time, for like 24 hours, then, I think that would either lead to enlightenment or madness.
Well, it's interesting because in Stainless Prajna, I think at the very beginning of this module, the first session, where Rinpoche talks or introduces the framework of Shamatha and Vipassana, there's some discussion in Stainless Prajna about states of absorption, concentration, what in Sanskrit are referred to as dhyana, or in Pali as jhana. These states of mental absorption or concentration that is often talked about, even there are Asian and Western teachers, probably more predominantly in the Theravada tradition, who are teaching jhana practice. And that's exactly what happens. The mind becomes absorbed, and slowly, slowly, sensory perception falls away, and there's a single-pointedness of mind that has certain mind qualities involved, but it is immune to sense perception, or secluded away from sense perception, so to speak. The interesting part about it, and well, even the stories that are preserved from the sutras, the early teachings of the Buddha, state that this is the practices the Buddha did on the night of his enlightenment. But having attained these deep levels of concentration or absorption, he then turned on the investigation of Vipassana and inquired into the nature of his experience. And it was the insight, the Vipassana, that led to enlightenment, not the absorption of the mind that gave him access to enlightenment. It just gave him the pliability of mind, or the power of a concentrated mind that he then directed towards inquiry or investigation. And it was the inquiry and the investigation that led to enlightenment, not the absorption, is my understanding. And every teacher I've had in Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, talks about shamatha and vipassana in much the same way, that the shamatha is necessary, but it is not enough. It's the shamatha, it's the vipassana that will lead to direct realization.
Yeah, that's what they say here.
Yeah, well, the reason being is that these jhana states, these states of absorptions, even if you were to attain a state of mind where sense perception was silenced, shall we say, it's conditioned. It is not unconditioned. It's only possible to achieve that through certain practices, certain causes, and conditions. And because it's conditioned, then it's not the unconditioned, therefore it's not enlightened, if that
Because
makes
it's set
sense.
by conditioned things, it's not truly conditioned, I
It's impermanent. So as soon as you come out of these wonderful
think.
states of absorption, you're back to where you were anyway. Nothing's changed. It doesn't
Exactly.
uproot the unwholesome tendencies of the mind. Only Vipassana will uproot the unwholesome tendencies of the mind. Yeah.
Damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Exactly. It's fun while you're in there. It's cool, you know. It's like taking a hot shower or a cold bath or whatever it is. It'll mitigate the distractions and the chaos of the mind. But as soon as you come out of those states, nothing's changed. It's like, oh,
Exactly.
I'm back here. Yeah. I'm still in reality. How
In
nice.
reality or whatever. Cool.
Yeah.
Thanks.
How we doing, folks? This is half over. Now's your opportunity. I don't know if there's any questions about the programs that Kunsung and I are doing this next month or two either. If you have any questions about this four-part series that'll begin in February, and then a second part will be in March, please feel free to ask. But Mary's got a hand up. Hi, Mary.
You can sign up for both of those now. They're all the second one's listed. Oh,
Yep.
sorry.
Hi,
Hi.
Mary.
My question is pretty simple. So I've been doing counting the breath, and I remember doing that last summer. And what I've really noticed is that I am not very good at that. And I've been doing a lot, I've been doing this. I've done Path of Liberation One, and I feel like I need a lot more practice, and I have been integrating it in my day, which has been wonderful, and I am getting better over the past few days. But
Yes.
I feel like by the time we get to Vipassana, I'm not going to be ready. And I remember saying something last summer about, well, you should practice it for an hour every day for, I don't know, was it 2 weeks or something like that? And so my question really is, I'm spending time on it and all that, but we go, basically week by week, and we go to new techniques. And is it, should I slow down, or should I just keep going and start the Vipassana, even though I don't think I have a very calm mind or, focus to.
Good question. It's true that we cover a lot of material week to week here, session to session, month to month, and it can be a little challenging to keep up. Once we've learned these practices, of course, we can always do them whenever in the future. We really, yes, if you're like me, you probably have a tendency to judge yourself harshly and not believe you're good enough in what you're doing. Within that framework and understanding, c'est la vie, I think it's also really helpful to realize we've been in samsara since beginningless time, and our habit to be distracted is fairly deeply ingrained. It's been a while. We've been doing this for a while now. And so we may not be able to turn it around on a dime. It's going to take some practice. And that's part of the problem too with the practice, because it's kind of has a stealth element to it. We don't see much change day after day. But I would imagine if you've been doing it for a few weeks, it already is beginning to make a difference. I also think that when we have busy lives, we all do, to practice this for half an hour and a day, or wonderful as that is, as beneficial as that is, and whatever transformation can take place as a result of that, I would say there's no substitute for doing intensive practice. Go and do it for a week. Go into retreat and practice this for a week, for a month. Mingo Rinpoche and his teacher, his fathers, his gurus practiced for decades in caves and stuff. Don't get me wrong, I don't want to turn you off or make it sound like it's impossible, but it may take a bit of time. One of the things that I really like about these teachings, and I think it's already, I know the five aggregates get mentioned in these six practices. I think the hindrances also come up. These states of mind that present themselves when we begin to do intensive practice, like restlessness and sleepiness and doubt and so forth, and agitation. And so forth. And if you've done practice in the Theravada tradition from any of the traditions that came out of Burma and or Thailand or Sri Lanka, you will have probably received considerable teachings with regards to these hindrances. And you will, if you've done intensive practice a week or 10 days or something, you will have definitely encountered them. In that tradition, they're kind of taught as the enemy, Mara, and need to be conquered or overcome. I really loved what the way Rinpoche characterized them as being signs of purification. So basically, when you think about it, if you've spent your life being, or lifetimes, endless, innumerable lifetimes being distracted, chasing after things you like and running away from things you don't like, as soon as you begin to show up, all those habits, stopped. They, in order for you to stay present and not run after something that appears that you like, you're essentially challenging that karmic pattern.
And
Your
that's hard.
yes, exactly. That's my point. And the momentum, the proclivity of that habit's going to act out. You know, like, oh, I don't want to stay here and look at that. Give me a break. You know, I'm out of here. You know, I know I can go and get some chocolate or go to a movie or whatever, you know, or I can beat up on this or what, you know, that's because that's what I've been doing since the beginning of this time, right? So knowing that that's the path to purification, that how one purifies one mind by showing up, be present, opening our heart and investigating the nature of our experience, that's what the teachings of this path teach. And in the process, we are going to encounter, often not in such a pleasant way, all the proclivity of our karmic habituated patterns, because we're challenging those patterns. We're saying, I don't wish to perpetuate these patterns. You know, I've had enough of you because you're the cause of my suffering, right? And so that's what comes up. That's what we're dealing with. And it's okay. Don't judge yourself. Don't beat yourself up. Just, you know, that's why, you know, the parameter of perseverance is characterized as joyful effort. You just have to pick yourself up, brush it off, smile and say, okay, I'm back on the mat.
So what I'm hearing is that when those hindrances start to come up, that I can see them as a positive sign that I'm doing something right. And even
yes.
though it's hard. So, and that's
yes.
okay. And so
yes.
Well, that's really cool. And just one other thing is that I've been doing this long enough so that I can't tell that, you know, anything happens very often, but over time, some certainly
yeah.
a lot has happened.
Yes.
And it's like, I just have so much faith and,
yeah.
you know,
Great.
In all of this, that it's like,
yeah.
okay, I'll keep doing
yeah.
it.
And that is really important. That faith is really important because it's verified faith. It's not, you know, belief. It's not, you know, thinking that, oh, this is, it's what we call verified faith. This, it is a confidence. Actually, the word saddha in Sanskrit and Pali that is translated as faith also has connotations of confidence. There's this stability and assertion of confidence that I know the Dharma works. I know that this is good for me and my loved ones, right? I know that there's a deep benefit from doing this, and that when I don't, or if I don't, if I fall off the wagon for a while, I'm going to suffer. Yeah. And that's really important because that's what gets you back on the cushion. That's one of the most important aspects of this, of the path. Yeah, the confidence that comes from understanding the Dharma. And, you know, because the light bulbs, as you listen, you know, how many times have I sat in Ming Rinpoche's teachings and the light bulbs just kind of go, wow, yeah, that's the way things are. You're right. And it makes sense. And you know that that's, yeah, there's a verification, a confidence that comes from that. From your practice.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. So just a little bit about these four-week programs that, so Kunsum's doing one session and I'm doing one session, but we're doing the same session. So you can choose to come to Kunsum's session or to my session. We're covering the same territory. I just hope we don't contradict each other too much. But you know, you probably learned something from either of us, so you can come to either session or both sessions. It's really up to you. The first program, the first 4 weeks that will be starting next month in February, are covering all of these practices that are in the Shamatha module that has that you now have access to, this third module, I think it is. So we will do these practices, counting the breath, following the breath, settling the breath, in these four various sessions. And there'll be, in the 2 hour sessions, there'll be a lot of time specifically for practice, but Kunsum and I will also be filling in a little bit of, we won't have any videos from Rinpoche or anything. It'll come, whatever content will come from Kunsum or I. And then in the March 4 week program, it will be specifically around the Vipassana practices that will come in the next module. Yeah, because we get back to the four foundations of mindfulness from a Vipassana perspective, the five aggregates and the four foundations of mindfulness. So we will be, once we've got a nice stable mind, we'll be starting to look specifically at the body, the feelings, the mind and the phenomena, etc., through a very particular lens. I just finished recording all my reflections, I think, for module 5, which I think you won't get to till April or March or April sometime. But if given that you've got access to stainless prajna, you can see, it follows the meditations in stainless prajna. So that's what we'll be covering, these six shamatha practices in February. And then I'm not exactly sure what, and I'm not sure what Lama Chinni's weekend is going to, how it's going to differ from what Kunsung and I teach. But you can be assured that Lama Chinni will obviously come at it from a more classical perspective, having been raised in the Tibetan tradition, in the tradition, Tibetan monasteries, etc. He'll have a great take on it too. Bruce.
I was wondering if you could go over settling the breath. When I first read it, it's got this whole full body breathing.
Yes.
That, and first I, is that a lot of imagination? I mean, I find when I do it, my thighs and my calves kind of expand and contract, or I guess I'm doing
Yeah.
it through muscle movement, but
Yeah.
then
You
how would you,
know, my sense is that, the counting the breath gets us connected to the breath, the following the breath, the in and the out gets us into the mechanism of the breath. And then we kind of cross from just the physical sense of the breath to the subtle body energy aspect of the breath, if that makes sense. That's what, I've had.
Well, they describe it.
Kunsung and I have met a couple of times to talk about this program we're going to be doing next month, the four-part program, and we had a lot of conversation, clarification in our own hearts and minds about this. She's been teaching these programs or this material at the Institute in Kathmandu with Justin Kelly and others, so she was a little bit more familiar with the techniques and particularly the understanding that comes from the tradition, the Lopong, the Lama that's helped been teaching in the Institute. But to the best of my understanding, yes, it's like a whole body experience that is not so tied to our anatomical understanding of how the physiology of our lungs and breath work. I think it's necessary for us to, I wouldn't say necessarily abandon that, but we go beyond that physiological understanding of an anatomical understanding of the lungs and the breath, and more into a whole body, subtle body energy, prana kind of sense of breath. That's where this is taking us, if that's helpful.
I think they get into that. I mean, every pore in your body breathes, and every cell
Yes,
needs to get the oxygen. So is that considered the subtle body, or?
I'm, it's above my pay grade to talk at any
Ah,
depth, at
me too.
any depth about subtle body practices. I've not, done any of the Salung practices that come to us from this tradition, either Mahamudra or Dzogchen. The six yogas, etc. So I don't feel qualified to speak at all, although from my own practice and conversations with Rinpoche, I've had experiences that would suggest that things are happening on the subtle body level that as a result of my practice. But it's a very, I think it's sufficient enough to say that the practice on the settling on the breath is moving from the just the physiological aspect of breathing to the subtle body, or the physical body aspect of the gross body aspect of breathing to a subtle body aspect of breathing and the energies associated with it. And I think that's about all I'm qualified to say.
Yeah, that's a little, it's a little confusing.
Yes, it is.
It is
It
very,
is.
I'd like to
Well,
get
in
this
Kunsung and
concept
I
of.
had a lot of conversation about this because you could say it is using your imagination, although it's in terms of imagination, we think imagination is not real, but just illusionary. And the tradition ensures us that this is not just an illusion. This is something that's really happening. And of course, our belief about, most of us, that have trained in the sciences anyway, or have basic understanding of physiology, our beliefs don't, come up against the barrier of perception of subtle body. But the practices of yoga, the practices of acupuncture, the practices of martial arts all relate to these subtle body energies in some way, and we're familiar with these things whether we've practiced them or not. So that's the territory I understand we're getting into. Qi, or yeah.
Cool.
Hi, yeah. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I had a question, very simple question. I'm just really curious as to why 10 is the number that you stop at. Is there some significance to the number 10, or is it just I went to that
No, I don't think there is. We could go back into the history of numerology or numbers and counting. Go and talk to Neil deGrasse Tyson about that, the history of how we got to be, our whole number system is based on the number 10. And not on base 12 or base 24 or something. It probably has its origins in the number system, the counting system of Brahmanic traditions in India, that this comes from. I think it's probably fairly arbitrary. I don't know. I've not heard anybody speaks specifically to the significance, or if there is any significance of 10, except that most number systems work on the base 10. Wasn't always that way. There were cultures, ancient cultures, that didn't work on the base 10.
Okay.
But
And I
I
hadn't.
think we have the Persian culture to basically thanks for our numbers.
Well, and then I had one other question.
Yep.
So being that it is just 10, for whatever reason, so let's say I heard Lama Trinley say that you can continue to count, like if you're, 10 is the right number, and then you continually count to 10 over and over and over and over. So at some point when you, I guess my question is, you're giving the mind a job to kind of keep you steadying on
Yes.
focusing on the breath. But when you
Yes.
Is it necessary to continue counting to 10 when you feel like, okay, I've got that, and just follow, just resting in that?
Well, my
Or.
understanding is, according to this system, that once we had achieved some modicum of success to being able to follow the breath, 1 to 10, 1 to 10, 1 to 10, we would then employ the second practice, which is following the breath, which is the in-out aspect of it. So in the in and out, yes, we're not expected to continue to count, but we're changing the method, the technique for being with the breath. So there's like these, it's nearly like layers of getting closer to noticing more detail of, more and more granular. More and more granular each step of these six Vipassana practices. that arrive then at the Vipassana practice, right? And then when we turn on the inquiry, then we're looking for very different things, but still at an increasingly granular aspect of our psychophysical experience. Yes.
So when we're doing the counting breath, we're not thinking about, I know at that the last Lama Trinley talk that he gave, he was going and overlaying the Four Noble Truths onto
Right.
each section. But when we're doing this right now, we're just focusing on the shamatha aspect, correct? We're not, we're all.
Initially, well, of course, in any of these practices, insight may arise, right? That's the nature. As soon as you bring your attention to your experience, you will see things that you have not previously seen. And so it's really hard to distinguish where shamatha ends and vipassana starts. There's this natural kind of, gray area, or if that's the right way of looking at it. The interesting thing is that once you get to the vipassana, the inquiry is very specific in terms of the questions you ask, or where you look, or what you're examining, or what you're the analysis, or because you're using analytical meditation, there's very specific things that you're directed to notice, like the impermanence and the suffering and the not self and so on and so forth, these characteristics that come in shamatha. But it doesn't take much to practice at all, some stability of mind to realize, oh, there's a lot going on here, things are changing, right? So, it's not that you shouldn't. It's just that at the beginning, the exercise is incredibly simple, just so you don't have to worry about anything else. Just keep coming back to the breath. But if you have some deep realization while you're just counting the breath, how nice. It's not wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You.
Yeah. Yeah, May, you got your hand up.
Hi. Hi. I'm just wondering where fear fits into all of this. It's not one of the kleshas, it's not one of the 75 Dharma factors, even in the extended list, as far as I could see. I know that there are the eight worldly dharmas where it is contrasted with hope, but sometimes it's so all pervasive, and I'm wondering where it fits into categories. If you could help me with that, please.
To the best of my understanding, fear fits into the root poison of hatred, aversion, anger, etc. It's get out of my face kind of response to unpleasant experience. Even if the unpleasant experience is not present, the perception that it may arise is also aversion in the mind. That's what I've always understood. I'd have to hit the textbooks to refresh my memory of what are wholesome and unwholesome states of mind. And but I've always understood fear to fall into, it's not, it may be elements of confusion or delusion. It's certainly not greed or desire or avarice. It is definitely an adverse reaction to the anticipation of something unpleasant, or the adverse reaction to something that is currently unpleasant.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. I'd been taught that it was part of ignorance, and of course it is in a broad sense, but it
Yes.
seems to fall more
Yes.
specifically into
Well,
the.
it could be perceived to be more in the face of ignorance when if the unpleasant thing is not present, but just projected or perceived to possibly be coming. Which is a lot of fear is based on not what's there, but the concern about it that something might arise that's unpleasant. So in that sense, it's probably, yes, definitely falls more into the category of ignorance. But it definitely, in my mind, is an adverse response to the perception, either the direct experience of something that's unpleasant, or the perception that something unpleasant may arise.
Thank you.
I mean, it's interesting. Actually, I think the last reflection that I just recorded, number 27, where are we? I don't know where we're at the moment in this course. We're at number 8. No, we're at number, this goes to number 15. So I just recorded number 27. And it is about the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. So we'll get there, in a couple of modules when we get through the mindfulness of body and the four elements, of body, and then get into the three characteristics or the four seals, greed, impermanence, suffering, not self, and emptiness. And then we'll get to the three poisons. So, this is a rich course. There's a lot in here, I tell you. It's amazing. I think I've mentioned a couple of times, I studied this or I practiced this in Burma with my Burmese teacher over 30 years ago. And I know it was mind-bogglingly transformative for me. It was a really amazing experience to be in Burma for 6 months and practicing like this from, I think we were getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, going to bed at 10 o'clock at night, and doing nothing else. It's completely in silence for months. So it was pretty intense. And to be drip-fed these teachings every day from Chamir Sayadaw. And, I know it blew my mind. I know I have never been the same since. But having, in my role now, revisiting this, particularly from a Tibetan or Vajrayana perspective, Lingpa Rinpoche, Abhidhamma, Basubandhu, even though I had, in this ensuing years, had continue to study in the Tibetan tradition, the Abhidhamma, it has elicited such incredible appreciation in me for my Burmese teacher, even to the point where I kind of just talking about him, I tear up. Incredible respect for these teachings and appreciation for my experience and gratitude, and also respect for the Dharma. These are, at some level, this can be perceived to be dry, whatever. But when you're sitting on the cushion and this understanding is playing out moment to moment, it's incredibly transformative and liberating. Highly recommended. Whoops. Look what's happened. We've come to the top of the hour already. How did that happen? So if there's, unless there's some last minute question that somebody needs to ask before we wrap this up, maybe we can. Yes, I see, Matthew.
I'm maybe not up to date with what we're studying. I've got to the end of the Four Noble Truths, but I remember doing the in the introduction to the Abhidharma section on feelings. I just find it really, really like I sit and I think that's probably unpleasant, that's probably pleasant, but I don't think I'm in touch with this feeling tone. So I just wondered if you had any sort of tips on noticing it.
Well, this is, one, first of all, I just want to say it's very subtle. It's and it is not easy so don't beat yourself up if it's confusing. I think it's confusing. I think a lot of the teachings about the Vedana, the feeling tone, are confusing. From my experience, when we like, even, think of something you really like. Physiologically, there's nearly this kind of attraction to it, leaning into it. Kind of, ooh, right? And there's a mental quality to that, or a mental component to that, that is drawn towards pleasant experience. That is pleasant Vedana. Now think of something you don't like. What would you not like to happen? Woo, the whole body pushes back. It's like, get out of my face. That is a visual reaction to an unpleasant experience. So this leaning in, pushing away, or leaning into, I like it, pushing away from, I don't like it. That happens at a mental level. It's very, very subtle. And of course, we see it play out more physically. Just the way I describe leaning into, pushing away from is more a physical response, but it's governed by a mental response. And so then the neither pleasant or unpleasant, or the neutral, as it's sometimes called, I try and avoid calling it neutral because I think it mischaracterizes it. Just our English understanding of the word neutral doesn't really work for unpleasant or neither pleasant or unpleasant behavior in my mind. But there's nearly like you don't know. There's a nebulous, confused disconnect, disassociation, even. You don't even notice it. It's not even on your radar what's not pleasant or unpleasant by definition in my mind. So anyway, play with it. See if that helps. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Now we've really gone over time. We must bring this gathering to a close. So thank you all very much for joining me and being with us today. Great stuff. So let's just take a little moment, shall we, to reflect on our time together. Whatever's come up for you. Whatever benefit may have arisen from our time, our discussion here today, let's dedicate it to the welfare and happiness of all beings, wherever they might be. May they quickly realize their true nature. Thanks all. Be well. Take care. See you next time. See you online, wherever, whatever. Thank you for your dedication, your practice, your willingness to be here. Greatly appreciated. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you, Edwin.
Thank you, Edwin.
Thank you.
Thank you.